welcome to wherever you are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to episode 75 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, matinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. We are ready to put 2012 in the books. We are ready to move on into a new year. It was the year that the San Francisco Giants won the World Series, Barack Obama got re-elected president, many other news stories happened, good and bad, but for better or for worse, we need to move on. And of course, we can't move on before we make lists. That's what this time of year is about, right?
Love lists.
I love me the lists. Yes, I do. But me making a list isn't any fun, so we have guests and lots of them. The first guest has been a friend of mine for a few years now. I actually knew of him online before I met him in person. I don't know why that happened, because you're local.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange. I was like, oh yeah, I know you. Yeah. It is Courtney Small from Big Thoughts from smallmind.com. How are you, sir?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me.
How's your Christmas?
Christmas was good. Lots of food. Lots of traveling. I'm actually kind of tired. There's still more dinners to go. So.
Yeah. Directly across from me at the table, Courtney has not come alone. He's brought his lovely date tonight. His darling wife, his lovely date. Ooh. Did he have to say, "Dear, dear wife"?
No, well, I don't say. That's another show.
He tells me that all the time.
Deon Small is here. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Welcome to the whole podcasting shenanigans. I don't know if you're used to this thing.
Not at all.
He does it every once in a while, but yeah. We're going to try and make this a happy and comfortable and welcoming place. And you've already heard the voice, the legend, the Baker Galore, as it were. Lindsay Rigoni is back for two episodes in a row.
Yeah.
I would say that people are getting sick of you, but it's probably more likely people are getting sick of me.
I am.
I know, yeah. 10 years on, you certainly are. So one quick note about how today's show is going to go. During the year-end episode, I like to back the discussion with some of my favorite songs from the year. Some of the artists you'll hear include Metric, Frank Ocean, Kishibashi. If you're interested in the full list of artists and tracks, check out the show notes. You can find the full list there. And if you aren't a fan of the music, rest easy, because episode 76 will be back to normal. On episode 75, we will be discussing our top 5 films of the year, but before that, we need to learn more about the Smalls. Alright, I'm going to start with Deon. Deon, do you recall the first film you ever saw in a theater?
Oddly enough,
you do.
Boomerang.
Wow.
Yeah, my parents, the Eddie Murphy sex film, basically.
With Robin Gibbons and Halle Berry.
I thought that's what it was, but I thought maybe it was an older film that I didn't know.
No, you were how old?
I can't remember.
Were you old enough?
No.
Okay.
I can't remember how old I was. But my parents thought it'd be a great idea to take us to a movie, not realizing what exactly they were taking us to. And I spent the majority of the movie with my father's hands over my eyes going, "You can't watch that. You can't watch that." So that's what I remember. I'm sure there was a movie before that, but that's the first one that comes to mind.
That certainly sticks. Did he start covering your ears?
No, it was mainly my eyes. I think he was in shock.
I imagine. Yeah. Courtney, do you remember the first one you ever saw in the theater?
I do. The first one was actually Transformers, the animated movie.
I was going to say, whoa.
Okay. Yes, I only started going to movies five years ago.
Yes,
It was.
I remember that.
Yeah, for me, the one that actually sticks out more for me is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but that came a year later. I always like Transformers. I do remember being kind of amazed the whole theater experience, and again, it was like being a kid. You watched the cartoon, so it was just.
Am I completely out of my mind, or wasn't Orson Welles a voice in that?
I believe he was, and I also believe Leonard Nimoy was a voice of.
Oh, that's right too.
Yeah. It's been years since I've watched it, but
anything? Did your parents cover your ears, or
no?
You just sat there and wondered.
Although I did see Boomerang in theaters, my cousin actually took me, and I don't even think my mom knew.
But I know how old you are. And like I have no clue, and nor am I going to ask because I'm not that stupid. But
I'm not going to give out her age.
No, exactly.
She is
a few months
older than me. So
wait a second. You would have been, hold on, because you're my age.
Yeah.
And that means you would have been, you know, of an already.
Not according to my parents.
Oh, okay, that's what it was.
I saw American Beauty with my dad and my stepmom, and it was the most mortifying experience of my life. And my stepmom actually said as we were walking out, your dad didn't expect there to be so many boobies. It was so uncomfortable. And I was older. It was just horrible.
I don't think I'm ever old enough for that. Like, with my parents.
I might as well ask you guys together, because I imagine it's the same answer. What is the last film you saw?
Actually, it's different.
Oh, okay. Well, then, Dion, what was the last film you saw?
No. Dark Knight Rises. Forgot about the late night screening.
I see. We are going to talk about that later, so I'll ask you what you think then. And what was the last film you saw?
I saw Django Unchained earlier today.
Working hard today, were you?
Working hard.
We're also going to talk about that later, so I didn't really think that question through. Dion, what's one of the worst films you've ever seen?
Without a doubt, the only movie I have ever walked out of in my entire life. It was billed as a African James Bond movie. I thought, I love James Bond. That's a great idea. Nothing but gratuitous sex and gratuitous violence. I walked out. And I was really disgusted when I walked out, and he told me it was a good thing I left. So...
It didn't.
I don't even remember that film.
I don't either.
It was horrible.
But I tend not to. If something looks like it might be violent, I'm not a big violent either.
I tend not to see it. But you bill it as James Bond. I can deal with James Bond violence.
Yeah. She has a weird thing when it comes to violence.
There's certain types of violence.
Yeah. If it's realistic, she's not having it.
Right. Okay.
But if it's something like Die Hard, Demolition Man, she's watching it.
Oh, I'm the same way. Yeah. No,
she doesn't want to kill Bill, which is oddly enough, because that's cartoonish, right?
I know.
Weird. Okay.
But with Viva Riva,
I can't even take that name seriously.
We're sitting in the theater, and clearly we realize, all right, this is not a James Bond film. This is more of like a Congo Godfather type film.
Okay.
Gangster film. She leans over. She's like, I'm gonna leave. I said, you know what? No. I think we only got 20 minutes left. So she stayed for another 20 minutes. And then she's like, all right, I'm leaving. And after she left, it got even worse in terms of the violence and the brutality. I was like, okay, I've kept you here long enough.
Brittany, what's the worst film you've ever seen?
Oh, there have been so many. I actually am going to say Firewall. Harrison Ford and Paul Bettany.
And Virginia Madsen.
Where Harrison Ford played this IT guy at some big bank. And Paul Bettany's a criminal who basically keeps his... Harrison Ford's family hostage so that Harrison Ford can break into the bank and help him steal. It was terrible.
Like, how did you end up choosing that?
I mean, in terms of...
Like it looked good to you?
Oh, it was on the... I think it was on the Movie Network.
Okay.
I was watching it.
You get suckered into a lot of bad stuff that way, you know? Like, you think, this might improve. What am I losing? I'm on the couch anyway.
The Movie Network, Netflix, you figure, I'm paying low for it. I'll just see what it is. And yeah, it was awful. I mean, that's worse than, Hollywood Homicide, the one he did with...
What's his name? He's not even really a star anymore. Josh Hartnett.
Josh Hartnett, yeah.
Wow. That is some bad stuff, guys. Dion, what's a classic or essential film you've never seen?
I've never seen Casablanca.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
You know, I watched more movies in the year that I started dating Courtney
than I
watched in my entire life to that point. So, and I'm probably not exaggerating.
Now, I want to call a time out there, because this is something that that I'm always interested in. As that happened, like, was there some resistance, or was this like, you know, I think this guy is obsessed, or... I think he needs a few more hobbies, or I want to kind of break him of this.
Not really.
I always kind of wonder, like, when a non-movie fan hooks up with a movie fan, if there's ever a moment where it's like, you know, uh-uh. Because I know, like, even you get that moment every once in a while, where I'm, like, watching the sixth heavy drama of the day, and you're like, I gotta go.
Well, the thing is, we just are both, I think, equally obsessed with movies, just in different types of movies.
Right.
So I have no problem. I could sit and watch six... you know, romantic comedies in a row,
right,
and not bat an eyelash,
right.
But you
Meanwhile,
watch
bail,
you
right.
watch too much death and destruction. I just think that's
okay,
too
much. But in the early going?
No, not really. It was more of a, you go do that, I'll see you later.
Well, that's good.
Thing.
Okay.
And then eventually I just started going to a few more of the movies. I mean, he'll tell me about them. I'm like, yeah, no, not going to happen.
Right.
Or, that sounds interesting, I'll go see it. Like, this morning he went by himself because I was like, there's no way in hell I'm going to see that movie. Sorry. So he went. I stayed home.
Gotcha. And how is Casablanca like? Have you tried, or you've seen it?
It's just one of those things.
Didn't know it was one that she had never seen.
Oh, well, now you got homework. You've been doing blind spot entries, but what's moved up the list now? What's the classic or something you haven't seen yet?
The Passion of Joan of Arc.
That's on my list too, actually. And so
Birth of a Nation, which I think is on Netflix. That's one that
I've never seen that either, but I've always been very curious.
Mm-hmm. Part of me just wants to see it so I can just speak knowledgeably of it.
Yes.
You know, I don't really want to watch a three-hour movie in the silent film.
Three hours? Yeah,
it's a three-hour silent film about the Clan, and I'm like,
really does not sound all that appealing.
That's not, but it's one of those.
But I think it's historically important in terms of cinema. Like, it's something that's what I'm saying.
Like, I just want to like rip the Band-Aid off one time. I don't want to read any essays. I don't want to go to any courses. I just want to let me watch it. Let me extrapolate, and off we go. Last question, Dion. What's a movie that, for any rhyme or reason, you wish you had?
One for the Money. It is a film that is based on the books by Janet Evanovich that I love dearly. It was Katherine Heigl, she played the female lead.
Oh, like earlier this year.
Horrible.
Oh, so it's based on good books, you're saying.
Horrible. The books are phenomenal. It was horrible. Start to finish, horrible. They cast it wrong. Like, Stephanie Plum is supposed to be a Italian, full-bodied, dark-haired, pretty but not gorgeous woman.
Sounds like my kind of girl.
Katherine Heigl.
Not so much.
Do I need to say more?
No.
Now, I've heard like three people so far in the last few months say that they will never in a million years go watch Jack Reacher because they've read the books and they're so annoyed that Tom Cruise is the opposite of how the character is in the books that they can't accept it.
No.
So obviously then you would want to make it so you could make it properly.
So I could see it done right. I don't know how I'd do that, but first of all, I wouldn't cast Katherine Heigl.
Can
you think of who you would cast?
America Ferrera, maybe.
Ooh, I'd see that.
She's the first one that comes.
Why like too excited when you hear
America?
No, but I know, in that kind of thing.
No, but I'm saying like I'm kind of used to her as Ugly Betty. Like she's not like 16. What are you doing? It's not like she said Chloe Moretz. I was like, yeah. Your turn. What's a film that for any random reason you wish you'd make?
For me, Hannah and Her Sisters.
Why?
It's my favorite Woody Allen one, and there's something about that script that I absolutely love.
Well, it's a great script. Like, that's kind
of one of the few films that every time I watch, I feel inspired to write.
Okay.
Like, whether it be a blog post or the first time I saw it, I was inspired to like start writing a script.
Okay.
Yeah, the script was terrible the first few pages in, but it was just every time I watch it, I just feel inspired to write. Like, it's something about the way how he orchestrates the relationship between the three sisters and their relationship with their significant others.
Yeah, there's a lot of wheels in motion.
Like,
yeah. Okay.
It's not as memorable as like Annie Hall or Manhattan, but it's just.
Oh no, it's up there. That's
it's one of those films I love.
Last year, I got more well versed in Woody Allen, and when I went through, that was one that I was like, oh, why hadn't I seen this before? So no, definitely good call. Good call, both of you guys. I like those answers for sure. We're gonna pause right there for just a moment. The way we're gonna do this is we're gonna go in kind of clusters. So we'll be right back with our choices of number 5, and then we'll take breaks in between the 4s, the 3s, the 2s, and the 1s. Right after this. Girl, you know you're lost in a thrill of it all. Miami, Amsterdam, Tokyo, Spain. Dion, you're going to get us started very briefly because we're going to talk about it later. What is your number 5 film of 2012?
Moonrise Kingdom.
What'd you dig about it?
It was just like a quirky movie. It was a fun watch. I don't know. I just enjoyed it. It made me giggle.
Yeah. It was one that grew on me. Like, I saw it a few times. But the first time I was like, that's pretty good. And then I watched it a few more times and I dug that one. But we'll get into that later. So, Courtney Small of Big Thoughts from a Small Mind. What is your number 5 film of 2012?
My number 5 is one that I'm sure some of your listeners are going to be shaking their head. But
I think some of my listeners will be tuning out.
Yes, Cloud Atlas.
Very good. Did you see it?
Nope.
And I know you didn't.
I haven't. I meant to see it, but I know it's a little long. And I just cannot bring myself to do it. I will watch it.
I saw it as well. I really, really loved it. Really great story structure. I know a lot of people take issue with all sorts of various things, which I don't really think is fair. What really kind of resonated about it for you?
I think it was one that I went in thinking it was going to be a spectacular failure. I like the Wachowskis' earlier films. Like, I really like The Matrix. I love Bound. Didn't like The Matrix sequels. Hated Speed Racer.
Really?
I know a lot of people like Speed Racer, but absolutely hated it. And I'm a fan of the Speed Racer cartoon.
Okay, that might be one.
But it was just, I like Tom Tykwer as a director, but the idea of having three directors doing this one project at the scale that it was. I didn't think it was going to work.
Yeah.
But, you know, 15 minutes in, after you do a bit of the guessing of which actor is which, about the 20-minute mark, the story really kicked in for me, and it just had me captivated to the very end. Yeah, there's some issues with it, but the fact that they were able to make this grand independent film, which by the time you walk out, you go, wow, I'm surprised they even put it in mainstream theaters, because it's not one that's going to attract a lot of people.
Yeah.
I thought it was just extremely well done.
Well, there's a lot of great themes in that, and I was really, really excited, so I'm happy you chose that one.
I thought the editing also was fantastic.
Yes.
Like, you're bouncing through six stories over, you know, close to 3 hours, and at no point did I lose track of any of the stories. Like, right. I knew exactly what had happened. I was still invested in each story. Yeah, there were certain ones that, you know, I thought were slightly weaker than the others, but the performances were great. Even the characters, even each actor playing different characters throughout, wasn't that big of a distraction after the first 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people have issue with it, and some people consider the film racist because you have white characters playing Asian playing white, black playing white. You know, no one does a black face, which, again, is...
I think that would have been the one step too far. They mercifully stopped there.
Oddly enough, it would have been interesting to see it done, because you have pretty much every character playing a different race to begin with. So it just seems kind of odd that you don't have, even if it was an Asian character playing a black character, the fact that that's left out was a little odd, because it was almost
they're
like...
They're probably too scared.
Yeah, at that moment, they realized, okay, we pushed things so far that this is what might put people over the edge.
Yeah. The cool thing as well about that, though, is that you mentioned kind of the editing and the way it's all cross-cut. It brings out a lot of parallels that aren't in the book, because the book separates each story basically into two halves. It tells you half of each one and then the other half of each one. And yeah, there are all these threads that if you're really reading, you'll recall. But a lot of these parallels, it really brought out by intercutting these stories very, very carefully. So I'm with you. It's a great movie, and I hope more people find it. Lindsay, you have a moment of truth, because you've been waffling on your number five. Dazzle us all. What are you going with?
Oh, I don't know. I'm going to go with Seven Psychopaths.
Very good.
Okay. It might have been Brave just because I thought it was very underrated, and I kind of wanted to give it some love, but I'm going to say Seven Psychopaths. It's hard for me to talk about it because I actually saw it so long ago. I think at that point, because it was earlier in the year, and it wasn't an underwhelming year up until that point. It was just nothing had stood out. I just remember watching it and just enjoying it so much. Like, every moment of it, I was just overjoyed with that. When the lights came up, I thought, this is just the greatest thing I've seen all year.
It's very self-aware, right? Like, in that kind of adaptation sort of way, because it's a story within a story. And as the story within the story unfolds, the writers of that story start, like, heckling it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's Christopher Walken doing his best Christopher Walken impression. He
adds, like, six more syllables to the words hallucinogens.
Okay.
Yeah, he's so just I don't know so how great. He does, and he says it as if it's the way it's supposed to be said, and you just hear it, and you're like, wait, what?
Sam Rockwell doing his best.
He goes,
you know,
he goes full Rockwell.
It was just, I thought it was a great story. It's interesting. I liked everybody in it. Like, I've never been a huge fan of Woody Allen. I really liked him in this. Woody Allen? I'm not actually thinking Woody Allen. Woody Harrelson. And Colin Farrell, I've never been a huge fan of either, but I just thought everybody in this was charming. It was really witty and smart and well written. And just like, there's some shots in it, like when you first see Tom Waits and he's just sitting there petting a bunny, and you're just thinking, what's gonna happen
to
them? Like, it's great.
They come home and he's sitting on their step just with holding a rabbit and just petting the rabbit. It's like, who are you?
I was a little tense going into this because I actually consult a website. I'm gonna give it a plug, called doesthedogdie.com. And it's a website for people like me who not stuff that animals were harmed in real life making a movie. It's just, I'm not good with, you know, when you see a movie and someone kills a dog. And I will have nightmares about it, even though I know it's fake, I know it's fiction. So it's a movie where it just forewarns people. Like, you can go and click on any movie and it'll say, this is what happens to the... Like, it'll even say nothing. There'll be a happy dog face next to it saying, animals appear in this movie, but none get hurt. But because I saw a test screening for this and it was not out yet, obviously it wasn't... And there's a lot... I mean, a lot of the plot of this film falls around this shih tzu that's been taken hostage. And there's, like, scenes where it's being held, like, for ransom.
He's in harm's way.
Yeah, there's, like, a gun to its head. Like, there's just... every moment was like, oh no, is the Shih Tzu gonna be okay? Like, it was really, but it's a really fun movie, and I would just recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, that's another one that I hope people catch up with. They didn't really latch on when it hit theaters, but
no,
I'm hoping people find
that movie. And it's something, I mean, yeah, seven psychopaths and there's some violent stuff, but it's nothing that you would want to watch.
It's really, well, speaking of movies where strange and awful things happen, my number five is Django Unchained. Which you just saw and you have not seen, and I know you haven't seen.
And you saw yesterday.
I just saw yesterday. It made that big an impression on me that it knocked the what would have been the number five out. Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's back 3 years after Inglourious Basterds. I think this is a really good follow-up. I don't think it's as good as Bastards, but I think it is a very, very good film for sure. He's mixing a lot of things in this movie. He's mixing, it's a revenge film, it's a black exploitation film, it's certainly a Western film. There, it's,
you lost
it's,
me. I don't like
that. That's what did it for me too. Yeah. I was like, no thanks. Go
really?
Ahead. Yep.
Nothing?
Not even, no.
Oh.
Not a single.
You know, I just don't like, I don't know what it is about Westerns, but even when we saw True Grit, everyone else was going on about it. I looked at my watch every 30 seconds just
but
wishing
along
it were
with,
over.
Okay, but time out, because it's not a modern classic True Grit type Western. It's a Quentin Tarantino movie that happens to have horses.
Which is why I will still see it.
Yeah, there is a lot of great dialogue.
See, but you said Quentin Tarantino.
And that's where I lost you.
You
right.
lost me there.
But I mean, okay. I also have a thing. I'm sick of Nazi movies. Like, I don't really want it. But last year, so I didn't see Inglourious Basterds for a long time. Because I was like, I can't take another.
Until DVD.
No, I didn't see it until DVD. Because yeah. I can't take one more Nazi movie. And then I saw it and I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. So I will give it, I do like Tarantino.
Did
so
you
I
like
will
it?
Give it
after, like, after all this?
I did. I'm still processing it. I think the reason why I enjoyed it is because it felt like a highbrow blaxploitation film.
Yeah.
More than it did a Western.
Right.
And I was telling my wife earlier that I watched a blaxploitation film called Drum.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier this year. Awful, awful film.
Okay.
But it was all about this slave. I guess it was supposed to be the unofficial sequel to Mandingo.
Oh,
and
okay.
He's a slave that's kind of working his way through the ranks. And it talks about the whole slave fighting thing that they touch on Django and how he's kind of torn between the slaves who think he's a little too uppity and the whites that just look at him as a regular slave and him trying to find his freedom and just some of the other black exploitation films I'd watched this year. So watching Django, it felt like
The Capper,
you know, this is how you're doing it, but he's doing it well, you know, bringing
right.
it, raising it up. So it's just not, oh, this is not just trash. It's interesting. It's one of those things where the first 20 minutes or so, I wasn't sure if I was going to like it.
Oh, really?
As much as I love Tarantino.
Okay.
It's like Tarantino setting a film during slave times.
We are not convincing
you know,
her.
I'm willing to go with him anywhere, but this one, I don't know.
Now, is
you know,
it worth the runtime?
Yes. Yeah, because you know what the funny
yes.
thing is?
That's
it starts,
also holding me back.
It starts to dip like in the middle. It dipped a little bit when Candy showed up, when Leo DiCaprio shows up, and they're kind of hatching things. And after like 15 minutes or so, that's when shit starts to get real with DiCaprio. And at that point, it just really ramps up all the way to the end. The last hour just breezes. And it's got this little lull. It's the same lull that's there in Inglourious Basterds. When they all go to the tavern and they talk for like 20 minutes, it's that same little in the action. But it's totally worth the runtime. Since you were watching a whole lot of blaxploitation films, I'll end my Django point with, did you notice Broomhilda's last name? The Kerry Washington character?
It was...
You noticed, come on.
I probably did. I'm trying to recall it now.
Her name is Broomhilda von Schaft.
Von Schaft, yes, yes. I do remember that.
Yeah, so, well done, Quentin. We'll be right back after this with our number fours. Dion, you're back up and you have my curiosity, as the line from Django goes, because I do not know what in the world this film is. Please tell the film and tell me about it.
The film is The Frog Princess. It is a documentary that screened at Hot Docs this year. It is the story of a bunch of individuals, adults, with special needs, putting on the play The Frog Prince.
Okay.
So it's just really neat. It follows them. It documents how they struggle with their disabilities, but also just how they struggle with, anybody would struggle with putting on a play. So it was just the interplay between all of those individuals, and they focused on certain stories and certain characters, But it just touched me. It's something that's near and dear to my heart. And
well, I was gonna say, like, when we sat down, you're mentioning, like, that's what you do for a living. So it's playing right to the fire. Did you see it as well?
Yeah, it was. I liked it. It was a very interesting film, and after watching, it was fun kind of discussing it with Dion, because there's certain, like, there's one character, the main guy, he's known as, his name is Rayman. It's not Rain Man, but Rain.
It's just too close, but
I mean, yeah, I was gonna say.
Yeah, but it was interesting seeing him, because, you know, he's like 20 something, and he thinks he's capable to move out on his own, but his mother doesn't feel that he's ready yet, because again, he's got autism, and there's that whole, he feels he's a grown man, should be on his own, and then you compare that with this other woman who is very dramatic because of her disability. She's always got to be the center of attention, and even when they're doing rehearsals and stuff, she's having tantrums and outbreaks just so that people can focus on her. And talking to Dion, I was like, yeah, you know, I have students like that in my class. Certain ones that, you know, when they're having a tantrum or an outbreak, if it's something actually serious or if it's just when they want attention. So it was interesting getting her perspective on the film after seeing it.
Well, that's the one thing I like about doing this kind of list is there's always at least one title that I'd never heard of or paid attention to, and congratulations, you win. Courtney, we're going to talk about yours in a little bit longer, but very briefly, your thoughts on your number 4, 2012.
My number 4 was Moonrise Kingdom, and to be honest, it was going to make my top 10, but not this high.
What
but
moved it up?
Similar to what you said earlier, I watched it go.
Okay. And crazy how that works, isn't it?
The second, because I enjoyed it the first time, but watching it the second time and just really paying attention to all the nuances and the dialogue, it's really moved up my Wes Anderson list. Yeah. Like, for me, my favorite is still The Royal Tenenbaums, but I would put Moonrise Kingdom as a close second in terms of my favorite of his films.
Nice, very nice. Your number 4 is one that we're going to talk about a little bit later, but tell people why you liked the film that you liked number 4.
Could you remind me what my number 4 is?
It rhymes with Schmargo.
Okay. Argo. Why did I like it? I thought Argo, mainly the storytelling, I thought it was very well done, very well put together. It was really very much an editor's film.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of my first time really experiencing Ben Affleck as a director. And I gotta say, I have a lot of respect for him. I mean, especially a story like this where it's not a surprise ending because it's based on true events. I just thought it was good filmmaking.
Cool.
And he created with the editing. I've heard other people say they didn't like the editing, but I rather liked it. And I thought with the editing, they created... The drama was created through not so much as the story, but the way the story was told.
Gotcha. We'll come back to it. My number 4, I don't know who's seen it at this table except that Lindsay has not. My number 4 is Lincoln. Anybody?
No.
Okay, I'm just going to talk.
I was too busy when you saw it.
Does anybody have any interest in Lincoln, or am I the only sucker?
I'm going to see it.
Okay. Not so much?
Because it's Spielberg, I have interest, and enough people have told me I need to see it that I'm going to probably see it at some point.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay. What I like about it, which maybe I'll sell you on, maybe I won't, is, okay, first of all, you take this, like, legend's life, and you tell a very, very small sliver of it. The whole story takes place within 6 months. The whole story, like, it's Lincoln, but it's really 6 months of Lincoln. It is the passing of the 13th Amendment, freeing the slaves in the American colonies at the time of the Civil War, and... what I like about it is that it kind of puts into perspective the fact that behind every myth, there is a reality that we choose to forget. So we think of Lincoln as this virtuous leader who rallied the nation together and passed through this really changing legislation. And America has done that a few times. They've done that with women's rights, and they've done that with civil rights, and they've done it recently with gay rights, and so on and so on. And we seem to have it in our head that when Lincoln did it, it was this virtuous rallying everybody together. Mm-mm. He got this through by hook and by crook, and just basically by bending the system to his, to what he wanted to do. And it's, a lot of it is based on factual research, and it's kind of just, that's what I like about it, that is dispelling this aura around a guy, like, you know, think about the Lincoln Memorial. The guy is sitting on a throne in a temple. He could not possibly be a more iconic American figure, and it makes him much more human, much more, like, in an uphill climb. And Daniel Day-Lewis is awesome. He's not playing Daniel Plainview. Like, he's not big and showy. There's one clip in the trailer, which is actually really annoying.
He's one of the few actors that I will go see a movie just because he's in it, because he doesn't do a lot, and he doesn't... The list of actors where I would say this about is a lot smaller than it used to be, because I used to say that about Al Pacino, and then he started being a little more generous in maybe what scripts he started accepting. And I feel like Daniel J. Lewis still is a little more selective. Like, he doesn't just take...
Yeah. So I say to you guys, check out Lincoln. At least check out like 30 minutes of Lincoln and see. You just go see it because you see more. You see most apt. Back in a sec with our number threes.
You can say goodbye to how we had it planned. Fear like a habit, run like a rabbit.
Dion, the biggest film of the year at the box office is your number three.
Oh, really?
Yepers. Why did you like that film so much?
I liked Avengers just because it was fun. It was...
Avengers,
We've been building to it, and we'd seen all the other superhero movies leading up to it, some with a little bit more love than others. And then I was really looking forward to Avengers because, I mean, I liked Iron Man, I liked, you know, the Hulk. I liked all of those ones, so it was fun. I really, really liked it.
I'm happy this is one I don't have to ask who's seen it, because we've all seen it.
I'm glad someone said it, because it was kind of in my top 10, and it didn't quite make the 5, but I wanted somebody to say it, because I love Joss Whedon, and I thought it was a great first superhero, no, I don't even want to say first superhero movie, I just thought it was a good, fun movie, and it hit all the points, and it made my least favorite comic book character ever, which is the Hulk. Probably now my favorite. Mark Ruffalo was great, and he took a weak character and put a soul into him.
The thing I love about this movie, a couple things. One, I love the fact that Marvel was able to stick the landing on this, because the year before Avengers, when we got Captain America and Thor, there was all of a sudden this little bit of, and before those two, we got Iron Man 2, there was all of a sudden this little apprehension of, are they going to be able to pull this off?
Yep.
Or is this just going to flame out badly? Because they lined all these films up and they said, we're moving to this.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that they were able to stick the landing and actually pull it all off.
And we're able to write Loki back in.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sure you'll enjoy that. And as to your point about Joss Whedon, I like the fact that this is a Joss Whedon team-up movie.
He knows how to write dialogue, and he knows how to have relationships between central characters like that, and for them to build too, so it's not just like we're this big happy family and we're all just...
Well, it's in a line with Firefly, it's in a line with Toy Story, it's in a line, certainly in a line with Buffy, so I was really, really glad that myself.
Yeah, it's one that made my top 10, not the top 5, but it was definitely one that cemented a spot in the top 10.
I just love the interplay between the Hulk and Iron Man.
Like, I want to see a buddy movie with the Hulk and Iron Man.
It just made it for me.
Absolutely.
And Ryan had his first shawarma after we saw that.
I was like, I need to try this now.
Before. I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
And it's one of the few superhero films that I find actually holds up really well on rewatch.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people said, oh, it's not as good the second time around. I thought it was actually better the second time around. Because even though you know all the surprise gags and stuff, it still played like gangbusters when you see it.
It's a lot, like you said, it's a lot of fun. And that might have been why a lot of people flocked to it this year, is for a big budget blow-em-up movie, it was probably the most fun we had in the theaters this year. Speaking of superheroes, but not speaking of fun, your next choice at number 3 is also a superhero film.
Yes, mine's The Dark Knight Rises, and I still say it's fun. I mean, Bane was a jolly fellow. Commented on the boy with a nice singing voice.
What a beautiful voice!
It's not as joyful as The Avengers, but...
It's joyful when you're watching it.
Even watching it again, when Dion was watching it for the first time last night, and watching it again, it still hit me in all the right notes.
You got the Christmas, didn't you?
I did.
Attaboy.
Well
done.
It was on the Christmas list. And it's one of those that, I guess one of the things I really love about it is Batman's gone for a good portion of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bruce Wayne has his back broken, and he's just gone, and the film was still riveting. Like, I liked all the other characters. I liked watching Bane do his thing. The stuff with Talia, I kind of knew it was coming, just because when she got casted, I'm like, oh, she's playing that character. But
and I don't know anything about Batman other than the movies. Like, I don't know the comic book, so I didn't know that was coming.
I didn't either.
When I start explaining it, I get that look.
I glaze over when he starts talking about the comic books.
I'm with you. I really like the movie as well. I still really like the movie as well. I watched it for the second time a few weeks ago. I think, like you said, I think it plays even better on rewatch. I think the pacing is actually a lot better. Than,
I saw it twice in IMAX, and the second time I loved it. The first time I almost stood up and cheered at the end.
than a lot of us give it credit for. It actually does hum along very, very nicely. The scale of this movie, they're going to try with Star Trek, because that's going to be in IMAX as well, but I don't think that anything is going to be this vast for a long, long time. I kind of wish Joss Whedon would try that with Avengers and really go bigger. I'm definitely with that. And you saw it for the first time last night?
Yep.
And we dig, or we...
Oh yeah, I liked it. It didn't quite make it there. Okay. But I did enjoy it, and there were some moments where it happened, and he knew it was coming.
I thought Anne Hathaway, I was so ready to hate her as I love her, but I didn't want her as
Catwoman. Yeah, she's an actress who had a good year. Huh?
She did well this year. Definitely did well.
And because I didn't read the comics, the only thing I knew of Bane was from which movie? Which
Batman
one was it?
Batman and Robin.
Yes. So when they announced that Bane was going to be kind of the villain in this one, like when it was being shot, I was like, really? The Bane? I think I said to you, how are they going to make that?
I'm like, just it'll be okay.
And I'm telling him, he's like, no, those movies, like that's not really Bane. That was just like an idiot puppet of Bane. Like it wasn't. Really how we... I really liked it.
Your number three is a film that we saw last weekend amidst the flurry of getting ready for Christmas. But your number three?
My number three is Silver Linings Playbook, which everyone was talking about at TIFF. I didn't choose to see it at TIFF because I figured it had like Robert De Niro and Bradley Cooper and I would get a chance to see it later. So I chose, and I was really surprised when did it win the Audience Award?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, that really surprised me because I there was a few I saw. I thought I'd seen The Sapphires. I thought that was going to win the Audience Award, and I love being able to say I picked the film that won the Audience Award. So I was a little actually annoyed when Silver Linings won.
Mine
Yeah, you got to see it. I think was this your first time ever choosing?
No, first time in a while because I saw Slumdog Millionaire.
I really did not expect to love this movie because I have a thing about Bradley Cooper's face. When I think he just has like a case of douche face that it doesn't matter what he says or what character he plays, it just rubs me the wrong way and I just always want to smack him. And I, from the first frame of this movie, I don't know what it is or what he was doing with this character, but I loved him from beginning to end. I have a total new perspective on him. I thought he was great. I thought Jennifer Lawrence was great. Robert De Niro, minus the gambling and the anger problems, was basically doing a 2-hour impression of my own father, which I couldn't get past. Like, I think I said to Ryan after we walked out, I was like, you noticed that, right? He was like, oh yeah, I noticed it. It's a great story, good character development, and I don't want to give away for people who haven't seen it what happens like towards the end, but it builds up to something that let's just say is up my alley.
Just a bit.
Just a bit.
You mentioned earlier One for the Money. And the thing I like about Silver Linings Playbook is it's kind of the tonic for One for the Money and the kind of crappy romantic comedies that we are being force-fed these days. So, you know, like, think about, like, you put these two films, they kind of share a genre. It's not a typical romantic comedy because it's not really that romantic.
And it's predictable.
The same way you know what's coming in One for the Money, but the two of them play so differently.
See, I didn't actually see Silver Linings.
Oh, I thought you did. Okay.
No, I've heard so many things about it that I'm like, because he saw it at TIFF and he's been raving about it since.
Yeah, and you know what's going to happen from, 10 minutes in, you've already
figured
out. Basically, the
Jennifer Lawrence shows up.
Yeah.
am I wrong?
No, it's...
Yeah, you've got a movie where you've got a guy and he's trying to get a girl back and another girl that he makes friends with helps him get the girl.
Yeah.
And you know what's going to happen.
What happens.
We've seen that movie over and over again, which is fine, but I just thought they did it very well.
The best comparison when I was explaining to her, I said it was kind of like Jerry Maguire, but better. In the sense that it's a film that both women and men can watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the romantic comedy with a bit of heart, this one's a little darker. But,
a little bit of football.
Yeah, but you walk away and both parties went, you know what? That was a good movie.
Yeah.
It's, I always forget that, Jerry Maguire is a good movie.
And that's not easy.
Right now, it's, I think, just outside of my top 10.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe if I see it again, but it's
well,
one.
You have to see it again. You have to take Dion.
Well, yeah, that's
but
true.
But this is the thing. Sometimes I think I've seen a movie just because of his description.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
My number three, I don't know if anybody at this table has seen it. You might have. You definitely haven't. Did anybody see it more?
No.
Great, awesome. I get to talk about this alone.
It was on my short list
at
Tiffany.
Yeah, tickets sold out. I couldn't get into that screen.
It's coming to Lightbox like next week. it's a French film. It's highly favored to like win Best Picture in a few months. It's kind of a stone cold reminder of what we've all signed on for. Because you know when you're up in front of your friends and your family and you're saying I take you for in sickness and in health, they don't really emphasize the sickness part for better or for worse. Should come with like 7 underlines, and I realize people can't see me waving my hand with the underline. It's the story of a couple and the wife just kind of, she has an episode kind of like a stroke, and that kind of leads her into Alzheimer's like symptoms. It is beautiful. It is shocking, strangely enough. It's got some really, really wonderful moments. Two amazing performances. And it just, like, I'm getting chills kind of talking about it. Because, like, it's, on the one hand, it is a sobering reminder of what we're all in for. One way or another. By the way, if I go first, like, can you guys, like, take her to Vegas or something? if I happen to go first, like I wanted to go have a good time. If I have to go through something like that. It's so beautifully done, and it's a film that stuck with me. I saw it like first thing on a Sunday morning, which my God was at the wrong time to watch a movie like this. But I really hope that everybody sees it.
I think there's nothing that's a good Sunday morning is not a good time to watch any movie.
Sunday morning is like made for something like The Avengers or Dark Knight Rises or something.
No.
Like this, it's certainly not
Midnight
made for.
Midnight is made for those.
It's certainly
movies.
Not made for a quiet, dialogue-driven French film about a woman who has a stroke.
Yeah.
I think every early TIFF screening I've ever seen
just
was
did
like
not go well.
And getting my eyes to read the subtitle because I'm not a morning person. Like I am,
right.
I am a different human being. Pre 12 p.m.
Yes, you are.
So my enjoyment of a film that I watch in the morning is not always a representation of what I may think of it later.
I see.
The thing that intrigues me about this film, though, is that judging by the other Haneke films I've watched, it doesn't seem like the typical film of his.
I can't say for sure. I've seen two others, and I wasn't crazy about them. And this one I really liked. Now, I don't know if it's because this is the first one I saw in a theater, because I think that affects your take on a film, or if it's just, it is, like you say, it's something very different for him. This is where you need Kurt Halfyard, because he would know. But yeah.
Because I've seen 4 of his films.
Yeah.
And, like, The Piano Teacher and Time of the Wolf, that's what I'm thinking, like, Cachet.
Yeah, this will kind of stand
apart.
This
one just seems like something that another director would have done, but not him, which I guess is also why it's really intriguing. Right?
Yep. So. Yep. Well, we'll be back right after this with our number 2s.
In my bed. Sleeping in my bed.
Here's where things are about to get fun.
Uh-oh.
And we're going to try not to derail this whole conversation.
What? Yeah, because it's coming.
Dion, what is your number 2 film of 2012?
Les Mis.
Oh!
Wait, hold on. Let me just get away from the table. Some fists are going to be flying.
Have you seen it, sir?
Yes, I watched it.
Where do you fall on this?
I fall directly in the middle
of
Dion's view and your view. So
tell us what you thought.
I loved it.
Okay.
I loved it. I cried. I knew it was coming. I sang along. I loved it. I don't care what anybody else thinks. I loved it.
What were your thoughts on Russell Crowe?
Oh, he sucked.
Okay. All right, let's just make that clear off the top.
I think we can all agree.
Sorry.
He was terrible.
He was terrible, but I was able to look past him because everything else was awesome. Honestly, the kids stole the show.
I thought the same thing. Gavroche and the young
cassette,
I loved
them. Amazing. And then also Eponine, the older Eponine.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And I was impressed with Anne Hathaway. I was impressed with
Hugh Jackman.
But you're right. He was horrible.
He was
but
horrible.
I was able to look past him because you know what? I sang along.
Yeah.
It was all good.
I was a little disappointed with Samantha Barks, who is Eponine, the older Eponine. I thought she outsang every other female in the entire cast.
Sure.
For sure.
Hands
but,
down.
I don't think she, being the kind of the only female in the movie who comes from the stage, I don't think she sold the emotion enough for me, like in terms of the acting. But she was like, I would rather, to be honest, because of some of the other singing in the film, especially after Russell Crowe, who neither acted nor sang,
that is
I would
true.
Take her over.
See, I actually, I really liked her.
I think she's like going to be a rising star.
I didn't
like
realize
her,
until afterwards that she had actually come from a theatrical background.
She looks familiar, right?
She comes from a reality show. You know how in Canada we have that, how do you solve a problem like Maria?
How do you solve a problem like Eponine?
No, it was for Oliver. I forget what it was called. I can't remember what the show was called, but it was in the UK.
Okay.
And she was fighting for the role of Nancy, which she didn't get, but she... I think Cameron McIntosh liked her enough in that he put her in a different, like a later production of Oliver, and then she was in the 25th anniversary edition of Les Mis.
Oh.
So she's like a legitimate Eponine. That's why, I mean, I do respect, she's probably the only main character in the film that I respect, because she's legitimate.
I got shivers when she sang On My Own. Like, I just was like, wow. Like, wow. I mean, I have to agree that Russell Crowe was pretty terrible.
I couldn't see past Russell Crowe.
No, you know what? I was able to... I think because it's a musical, and because it's familiar, and because I know the songs, and because I've seen it done before on stage, and
You think you're filling in some blanks?
I think that's exactly what happened. Okay. I think that, you know, I could just look past... I was like, Russell, oh, right, he was in that.
I was
like,
so ready to push him off that bridge.
You know what? He took too long to jump. But anyway...
I was just like, jump! Like, I knew it was
really
coming, but it did not come back.
Sorry about that. But, no, I really did enjoy it. Like, I cried. I mean, he says that's not really, you know, a measure of me because I cry all the time.
I disagree with him. I didn't cry. That's why I don't like it. But if a movie makes me cry, I automatically think it had to have been a good movie.
Yeah.
Because a bad movie can't make
you... You cry when you open the fridge and we're out of strawberries. you were saying, you're kind of in the middle on this?
I'm in the middle. I knew nothing of Les Mis. Hadn't seen any of the film versions. Never seen the musical. So I went into the story completely fresh.
How'd that work out?
For the most part, it was alright. I enjoyed it. There were some issues I had with like the way how the story was structured, especially the editing in the last half.
Oh god, the editing.
Yeah.
The editing. Like, my heart is just hurting right now thinking of it.
As somebody new to the story, do you have any clue what they were fighting for at the end?
That was one of my problems.
There we go.
Again, with going back to the editing, there was characters that I think it was like, was it Maris? His grandfather or uncle, whoever, shows up in one scene, makes one reference.
That was weird.
And then he comes back later and they're having this big number and he's like, you have returned and come home. Who is this guy?
Yeah.
Was this a guy that died? It took me a while.
Ghost?
I must admit, I probably filled in some blanks, but I still...
No, but I mean, there was a lot that I did like. I liked a lot of the musical numbers. Again, I thought Anne Hathaway was fantastic. Samantha Parks was great. Like, most of the acting outside of Russell Crowe was
now,
good.
Did you understand? Spoiler. Everybody knows.
Yeah,
Les Mis.
Go right ahead.
If I didn't know the show as well as I did, because Russell Crowe was so bad, I don't think I would have understood why he commits suicide. Because he didn't emote anything.
We argued about that point on the way home.
Oh,
yeah, because there are... I mean, in the show, it is... You actually weep for Javert in the show. When any other actor has... I've seen a lot of actors play Javert. Every time, I mean, you hate Javert because he's kind of he's the bad guy. But when he has that kind of breakdown and everything he believes in is shattered and he can't take it and he kills himself, you feel... Like, it brings tears to your eyes. And Russell Crowe, I kept thinking... I was actually so distracted by thinking, oh my God, is anybody going to understand? This doesn't make sense. Why did he jump? He just jumped. And, like, well, he said the words, but he didn't... There was nothing in his face, nothing in his eyes, nothing...
But we did. We argued about, like, that exact point on the way home. He's like, he jumped off a bridge, why? Like,
he said,
because he can't deal with the fact that...
Everything he knows is wrong to some extent.
But that's not there well enough in the story.
I thought Russell Crowe completely was vacant. It's my most disappointing film of the year because I think it had the potential to be the best film of the year. And it was my... I think on my list of films, I saw... It was my number 47.
Oh, jeez.
Which is upsetting for me.
What I'll say is this, because I have argued about Les Mis enough for 2 days before he cares.
So I actually stopped arguing.
Oh, he was a big fan of it, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I saw on Letterboxd,
go take a look at my comment section. That goes for a while. I do see what people like about it. Like, I'm not going to be the guy yelling at the rain saying, this movie sucks, you're all crazy, I don't know what's wrong with you. I don't know if maybe I was, like, I just kept getting pulled out because of technical things that kept, like, stopping me from getting caught up in my emotions. Maybe that's it. What I will say is that the first 30 minutes of this movie are awesome. From the minute you see that flag in the water to the minute Anne Hathaway stops singing I Dreamed a Dream, I will watch that 30 minutes over and over and over, and then I will hit stop.
That first number I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, yes. It really was. And there were a few little moments that I liked. I liked it when they did Do You Hear the People Sing, that everybody was kind of gathering in the streets.
I wanted more of that.
More stuff like that, because generally what I thought the film was lacking is... The difference between a stage version and a film is I expect them to be able to do much more with a film than they could ever do with a musical. And other than a couple select scenes, I felt that this was a very isolated, and it felt more cheap and empty than a stage production. That it should have been a little richer. I feel like there was no sense of space or vastness.
Right.
I should have felt like they were actually... I felt like they were more on sets than I do that on the stage. On the stage, because they're just there and it's minimal and you disappear into the songs... It doesn't even matter that it's one person standing alone on a stage. Here, I felt like I'm watching, especially One Day More, which I thought was the biggest failure of the film. I did like the little added touch when they had Eponine kind of taping herself up and making herself into a boy, but the set she was on, I felt like it was just her in front of a screen.
See, the thing
it was
for
just...
me, though, is music will always get me.
Yes. Me, so I mean, normally me too, that's why.
As long as the score is good, the movie could be crap, and I'm like... That was fantastic.
If you look on my DVD shelf, I have the film version. I have the film version of Phantom of the Opera, which is terrible. So, and I have Rent, and I have Mamma Mia, and I have Dreamgirls. I have Nine, which he won't.
Which means she will be buying Les Mis.
Yeah, I am a Renthead as well.
But that's the thing for me. Like, honestly, if Russell Crowe. But if you can sing it. You've got me.
Gotcha. And I think my problem is too many people couldn't sing it in this film.
Well, I'm going to move you on from this argument.
I could talk about this.
You're about to get into another argument. Number two film, Courtney Small.
Yeah. See, my number two.
What is it? Oh my God.
I keep flip-flopping because that and my number one, they're pretty much neck and neck.
They're one and 1A?
Yeah. It depends on the day.
Okay.
But right now, my number two is The Master.
I'm not going to criticize.
I'm a big Paul Thomas Anderson fan, and The Master is just... There's no other film that really came close to it in terms of what he was trying to do. I like the fact that every person I've discussed the film with has come up with a different interpretation of it, different idea of what's going on. It's not an easy film. Mm-hmm. It's a dense film.
It's not an easy film.
But the performances are fantastic, mm-hmm. and it's one that... makes me think. Every time I talk about it or I see someone mention it, I start thinking back about the film, certain scenes, certain aspects.
Which one's The Master again?
Joaquin Phoenix and
Phil Seymour Hoffman.
Loosely based on Scientology.
I think it was very loosely based.
Okay, mm-hmm. I remember you talking about it, but I didn't see it. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if it really did well at the theaters,
but it's not
the type of film that would do.
No.
I remember in my screening, I think I was the youngest person in that theater.
Cool.
I didn't enjoy the film, but I can't argue with your logic behind liking it. There's a lot of things I did like. I thought the performances were all Oscar-worthy. I thought it was one of the most beautifully shot films of the year. It was very rich and saturated. I liked the look of it, and we saw it in 70mm. It was really gorgeous. My problem with it was it left me feeling cold, and I'm fine with films that don't have strong narrative and don't really have a big story to tell, but this just felt... I don't know. It didn't seem to have a point of view. I got to the end of it and I was like, what were they trying to tell me in that film? And again, not every film has to have some kind of message, but I just felt like this was just rambling and I needed to get the hell away from Joaquin Phoenix's face.
A lot of close-ups on this.
You start to feel very... Which is fine because they're going that, but just to see someone who's a drunken mess really tightly shot, for after a while you're like, oh my God. No offense to Joaquin Phoenix, but I just needed him to step away from the camera for one moment to let me breathe.
This was one of the films, I actually saw this twice in theaters this year. I saw it twice in like the span of a week, because right after TIFF, it opened in Toronto the next weekend. I'm like, I think I need to watch that
again.
And
it was our last film of TIFF.
Yeah,
it was number 25 for both of us, and we were kind of beat.
Oh man, there are so many things that I took away from this film. Things about addiction, things about the dynamics of power within a religion, the dynamics of power within a relationship, because Amy Adams is the wife of the Phil Seymour Hoffman character. What's his name?
Lancaster Dodd.
Dodd, yeah, she's Dodd's wife. And in a lot of ways, she's actually the master because she has got this.
Isn't that always the case?
I can't speak for every married person who might be listening to this show, but there's a scene in this film where she exerts her control at a bathroom sink in a certain manner. And if every man who's listening to this goes through that on even an annual basis, there is something very strange happening in the sexual politics of the world.
But I think
I'll explain to you off air.
I was like, what?
What could he possibly be talking about?
For you or males who see this and they're like, wow, it's amazing. She was really the master. I think it's different from a female perspective because a woman, I think, would see that and just go, yeah, that's... Well, that's
every,
not news.
The thing is, like, every,
the wife
every
is
other,
really in control? Of course.
Of course. No. But every other moment that she has, like, when they're at the table and she's setting out how things are, and they're in the office and she's setting out how things are, and she's, like telling it to the congregation and everything like that, at every single turn, you're like, yeah, she is really the one. She's the one who's driving him and the one who's driving this movement. It's just the cherry on the sundae that we get this extra scene where
that was
like,
creepy. That scene was creepy. Yeah.
It's creepy and awesome.
Okay,
and we're
I
like,
definitely need to know when we're off air.
Okay.
Slightly disturbing.
Yeah, it is. It's an awesome movie. There's a lot to take from it. I think it actually makes a good little American history trilogy with There Will Be Blood and Boogie Nights.
Yep.
And certainly the second time I saw it, I took a lot more from it, and I can't wait to watch it again. So, good call. Lindsay's so on it, and now we have.
I didn't hate it.
We have Dion like seven kinds of curious.
Yeah.
Your next film actually is another one that a lot of us don't know about, including myself in this case. So you get to carry the torch on this one. You saw something from Spain.
Now, I'm gonna totally not say this right.
I'll fill you in.
Film is Blanca Nieves. Is that how you say
it? Hey, look at you go.
Is that how you say it?
Blanca Nieves.
I may not be saying that right, so I just want to put that out there. It is a silent film from Spain. I actually normally wouldn't put this on my list right now because it doesn't have a U.S. or a North American release yet, but I thought I normally would save it till next year, but it is Spain's... they did enter it for the Oscars this year, so I guess it does count for a 2012 film.
Sure.
It's a silent film based on the story of Snow White. And when I walked out of it, it actually, at the time when TIFF ended, it wasn't my number one film at the time of TIFF when I made my list then. But the more I think about it, the more I think this film is just beautiful and I loved it. And I was kind of prepared to dislike it because it centers around a bullfighter. And I have a...
Snow White, Blanca Nieves herself is a bullfighter, right?
Her father was a bullfighter. Yeah, so there's a lot of bullfighting in it. I have a prejudice against bullfighting. I have a very strong problem. And when we saw Is It Talk to Her,
mm-hmm.
one of the main characters in it, who early on kind of goes into a coma from bullfighting, I found I didn't like the film because the whole movie I was like, oh, who cares about this woman who was fighting a bull? Like, I really have a
She strong, got what was coming.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, like, who cares? She put herself in a situation where she can hurt the animal and the animal can't hurt her. So I kind of thought I would have a bit of a prejudice and not like the characters going in, but that wasn't the case at all. This is probably the most gorgeously shot film of the year. Some of the images are so stunning. It's in black and white. It's a story of Snow White, but not told
slightly differently.
It's
the third Snow White film from this year.
It is the third, and I actually think it's the best Snow White film from this year. No, the only thing I do remember, there was one moment in the film that I thought was a little cheesy. I remember just being really taken aback from it because it was one thing that was a little cliched. But generally, and I don't think there was... I kept counting the dwarves. Because I don't think there's seven of them. Because it's kind of like not the story. Like she kind of becomes like a bullfighter and she meets up with these dwarves who... They kind of market themselves as Snow White and the dwarves. But I remember keep going, but there's not seven. And I'm missing a dwarf. So every time they were all on the screen together, I would count and be like, okay, one must be off screen. But I don't think there's seven dwarves.
That's awesome.
I was very distracted by that. But
the
cinematography in this is just the most stunning images I've seen this year. And... it's kind of got the silent film vibe as the artist. I think people might see it because that had built a bit of momentum. But I actually think it's a superior film to the artist.
Well, I do know that it got picked up, so it is going to be hitting screens in 2013. I think the Weinstein Company got it, but don't quote me on that. So yeah, I'm. It's one of those ones I wished I could have squeezed it in it too.
I'm surprised you didn't, because you always try to see something different, like a silent
film.
And this was just, I have to say,
and I love
gorgeous.
Spanish films too, so it's like... Just
the look of this film, the costumes. The girl who plays Snow White has these eyes, like these big, beautiful eyes that you just when she's on camera, you almost can't stop looking at her. And the little, there's a lot where it's young Snow White in a lot of the film, and you just, she's so beautiful, you can't take your eyes off her.
Mm-hmm. Well, my number two, we mentioned it earlier, my number two is Argo. I already asked, but remind me, did you guys see it?
Yes, it's actually number six.
Okay, it's one of
just missed my top five.
Unlike you, I really like what Ben Affleck is doing as a director. I'm kind of surprised.
I wasn't terribly aware of what Ben Affleck was doing. I kind of had a prejudice, like, oh, Ben Affleck made a movie, you know? So I don't think I was seeing his films because...
What I like about this movie is it is pure execution. I kind of compare this film to, in a way, to a film we saw 2 years ago. I compare it to The Fighter. Because the minute the movie starts...
See, I had a problem with the execution of The
Fighter. Right, but the thing is, story-wise, with The Fighter, you know exactly where it's going to go. You know exactly where this road is taking you. And yet, for me, with The Fighter, not so much for you, I was with it. I had chills going with it. I was, like, pumping my fists.
This is another movie I want, a spin-off buddy movie with Alan Arkin and John Goodman. Let's just, like, give them a movie. Find a way to put them together. Yes. That would be a great film.
Yes. And that's what Argo does. Argo is based on a story that a lot of us know. Not everybody knows, but a lot of us know what happened and how it all turned out. And yet, it is constructed in a way that keeps it really interesting, that keeps the tension up. And it's just, you know, it's filled with all these great touches, all these great performances, a whole boatload of character actors who you're like, wait, he was in this? Yeah, well, it's, you know, like, they're all done up like 1970s. They're under mustaches.
The guy from
Dazed
and Confused.
That guy?
And one of the girls, she was in, like, an episode of Buffy and some other stuff. And I'm like, where's she been?
Right.
Like,
Tate Donovan was, like,
where did he come from?
Yeah, like, where'd they get Tate Donovan? Mm-hmm. Scoot McNairy was the guy who can speak Farsi. He was in a lot of movies this year.
What else was he in?
He was in Killing Them Softly.
Oh, I haven't seen that one yet.
He was, he's a guy from Monsters, so I'm like, good
just
on
the
you.
Fact that this movie made my top list says a lot, because not that...
You don't like political dramas.
No, well, no, I
they're
do,
on the right-hand
not...
side of the show.
I do like them, but to me, they're watch one time, and then I'm done. I can always appreciate them, but I'm not drawn to them. Like, right. It's not something... So I was very surprised to love this film.
No, so I really like this movie. I've watched it twice now. I can't wait to give it another look.
Yeah, it's one I'll definitely be watching again.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's it for our number twos. We are going to take a pause here, and another little tradition that we have on the year-end show is we like to hear, people to chime in who've been guests on the show through the course of the year. So here are the number one choices of 2012 from a few of the guests on the Matinee Cast this year. Listen up.
Velvet Cafe in Sweden. The best film I saw this year was We Need to Talk About Kevin. Or wait, Amour. Or Life of Pi. Moonrise Kingdom. Searching for Sugarman. Why, this is so difficult. I'll say We Need to Talk About Kevin, but it's really a close call.
Hi, this is Tim from The Mind Rails. My top choices for my favorite films of the year. Paranorman, Skyfall, finally, top of my list, The Hobbit, just for sheer enjoyment.
Hey, this is Sasha from Toronto. You can follow me on Twitter at ThatSashaJames. My favorite movie of the year is probably The Dark Knight Rises, because it's freaking Batman, and it's got Michael Caine crying, time bombs, ridiculous villain voices, and it's got Marion Cotillard and Christian Bale's glorious face moles. I'll talk to you later, Ryan, and I hope your listeners have a really good new year.
Hello, everyone. This is Andy Buckle from the Film Emporium in Sydney, Australia, and the best film I watched in 2012 was Holy Motors.
Hey everyone, this is Dan Fogarty of FogesMovieReviews.com and the title-pending movie podcast with Dank and Fogs. So far, the best movie that I've seen in 2012 is the new James Bond film, Skyfall.
Hi, this is Andrew from GManReviews.com calling in from Kingston, Jamaica. And I'm going to say my favorite film of 2012 so far has to be Abbas Kiarostami's Like Someone in Love. The film is just gorgeous on its own and refuses to let anyone love it once you're ready to buy into the beauty of it. And I'm going to say that. And everyone, please go watch the FP. It is the best film that wasn't 2012, but really is. I think it is. Thank you so much and good night.
This is Joanna from Real Feminist and Filmoria in New York, New York. And the best film I saw this year was Leave Me Like You Found Me.
This is Tom Cliff from Melbourne, Australia. And the best film I saw this year is a really obscure pick, Don Hertzfeldt's It's Such a Beautiful Day. Brought to life through a combination of doodles and experimental photography, but is more original and more powerful than any feature-length film I saw in the past 12 months. Do everything you can to catch up with this movie.
This is Kristen Griffin from AllEyesOnScreen.com in Chicago, Illinois. And the best film I saw this year was The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Hi, this is Dan Heaton from Public Transportation Snob in St. Louis, Missouri. And my favorite movie of 2012 was Wes Anderson's Moonrise Kingdom.
Hi, this is Jess from Real Insight and the Real Insight Podcast in upstate New York. And the best film I saw this year was Argo.
Hey, matinee listeners, this is Andrew James from the Row 3 Cinecast. My favorite film from 2012 was actually one that topped a lot of lists last year, and that would be Café de Flore. It's a fantastic film that mixes the celebration of life along with some really great music. So put it on the biggest screen you can find, turn it up as loud as your neighbors will allow, and enjoy. Everybody, have a really great and prosperous 2013, and we'll see you all online. Cheers.
Hello, my name is Stevie Taylor from Cinematic Paradox in New Zealand, and my favorite film of the year was The Dark Knight Rises, obviously.
This is Matt Brown from the Memo Podcast, and the best movie I saw this year was Prometheus. What?
All right, guys, moment of truth. We're down to our number one films of the year. I have seen all of them. I'm impressed with all of them. You can all stay. had any of you chosen anything completely extraneous, I would have revoked
Pitch
your
perfect.
Invitation. No.
You God, would, you I, would,
although
say,
I have to say,
no, I no, do not do
it. It was so good.
It's in my top 10. Completely
all right, I'm going to put away my man card for a minute. Pitch Perfect was a lot of fun.
All
and fine. Now I'm going to take my
Trading
man card back.
You are all fired.
I'm sorry. We know
I am ending this show without
cute.
Number one. Dear Lord. But, Dion, what is your number one? It is a wise choice, indeed.
Skyfall.
Atta girl.
I loved it. I love James Bond movies. I didn't like Daniel Craig.
Really?
Skyfall
like really.
Changed my mind.
Okay.
For me, I grew up with Roger Moore. Roger Moore was my Bond. In this last movie, Craig has changed my mind. He was phenomenal in it. I loved it. Like it was. I loved all the homages to the. Sorry, I can't say the word now. All of a sudden, to the past Bonds. I loved the scene in the museum with the new Q and the exchange. That like they just did it really well. Like, you know, we're in a new age, and yet there's all these little harkens back to the previous films. I loved it.
I think I said this during my actual review of the film, but I think one of the things I liked about this Bond is it is the first one to really acknowledge the fact that the character is aging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been used to him being just this ageless character. He's just stuck in time. He's a number. But this is the first one to say, you're not 29 anymore. You've lost this. You're not even 30 anymore. You've lost a step. And how we deal with that, because we all go through it, right? Like, we all wake up one day and something hurts that didn't hurt the day before, and we can't do something that we ordinarily could do with ease. You just don't expect that out of your superheroes.
Yeah.
Now, you weren't completely nuts about it.
Well, I should say I'm not a Bond fan.
This is
not
correct.
Because I'm anti-Bond, but because I probably have only seen the bad Bonds. Like, I saw the one with Halle Berry.
Oh.
Die Another Day.
Like, I think that was the first
Which
Bond I've ever seen.
Which they played on TV, like, every third day. Like,
yeah.
All through the season. Like,
I'm
December,
pretty
October.
Sure that was my introduction to
I'm
Bond.
I'm darn certain that was your introduction
so
to Bond.
That would do it.
Yeah.
And I have seen all the Daniel Craig ones, and I'm not a huge fan. I think, how long was this movie? Like
two and 20?
I think there was 45 minutes of a fantastic movie in there, and the rest of it, I'll admit, I was incredibly bored. Like the first hour, I was so bored. The whole thing when he was at the casino, and I just kept, I think like it was like the longest eye roll you've ever seen.
But there's a man-eating lizard!
I don't know why, I was like, eh. But then, this from the moment Javier Bardem shows up until the end of the courtroom scene, like, and the stuff in the subway, I thought that was outstanding. Really interesting. And then it nosedived for me again.
So you weren't crazy about it when they went out to Scotland and they went to Skyfall. Spoilers for Skyfall.
Sorry, what is Skyfall?
his house.
Oh, I was...
Did you not catch
by
that part?
By that point, I was so mad. Yeah, I was done.
There's a big stone, like, gate that says Skyfall. There's a stag on the top.
Yeah, I was done. I was just not...
See, I liked how they had to, like, go back to old Bond. Like,
I did love Albert Finney showing up, though.
I love the whole, you think your technology is the be-all and end-all? Well, I'm going to play that against you, and now what? Like, yeah. I loved it. I just thought it was
fun. I was so annoyed when...
he's forced to do things now with a gun and a radio, and that's all.
Yeah, like...
Well,
yeah.
Prop was up there. You, I know you dug it.
Yes, I really liked it. And one of the things I actually loved about the film was the dynamics between Bond, Bardem, and... Judi Dench, M,
mm-hmm.
and the whole kind of parent fighting children.
Yeah.
And then also, this is the first time where it really questions why James Bond does what he does. Because it's like, oh, for a queen and, you know, country. But it's like, well, your country doesn't really, you're expendable to them.
Yeah.
You know, and yet you still keep going. Yeah. You know, that's the big thing about Bardem. He was essentially Bond before Bond and then got discarded, you know, went through torture. And then even when he comes back, they're like, oh, you're alive. Well, that's good to know. You know? So it wasn't just the typical, I've come to take over the world or take over the water wave or control the global TV networks. It was simple, I want revenge on an organization that...
And specifically one person.
Out. Exactly. One person that chewed me out. And hey, you know what, Bond? She chewed you out as well. You know, and you're still protecting her. Why?
I'm with you. I really like the movie. I think it's got a little bit of sag. Like I Lindsay's on to something where a little bit probably could have been trimmed. Probably could have gotten down to around 2 or 2:10.
I think if they trimmed like 30 minutes out of it, it would have been. I would have
maybe
liked it. I think it would have been.
But
just was bored for too much of it.
For me,
but I see how Bond fans would like.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I can see how.
See,
it,
the thing for me,
movie.
it kind of echoes what I said about the Avengers, where for the film that was just rife with problems for years when MGM was having bankruptcy problems galore, for this to drop on the 50th anniversary and be this good,
mm-hmm.
It's like you got really lucky and you've done really well all at the same time. Like you've that extra bit of luck that you needed, you got it. What was your number one choice? So what's the last word on Skyfall?
It's fun. It pays, you know, it honors previous Bonds, and like you said, I really like the idea that they've said, okay, Bond is aging,
mm-hmm.
What now?
Good, we'll see where they go for it. Good luck going forward.
Yeah.
that's what we got. Courtney, your number one intrigues me to no end, because I watched it, I want to say 2 weeks ago, after hearing a lot of y'all talk about it for months. It is a documentary. Tell people about it and tell people why it was your number one choice.
My number one is The Imposter. It is a documentary about this, how should I say, this man who basically assumes the identity of a missing child. It's not really giving away too much because you pretty much get this in like the first 15, 20
yeah.
minutes. They actually talk to the imposter about how he did it. The story is this child disappears, a couple years later.
2 or 3 years
yeah,
later.
Yeah,
he's gone a while.
The parents get this call that, you know, the child has been found in Spain or something, and, you know, the sister goes to get him. Every indication tells you that this is not the child.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that everything from the eye, the hair, the guy's got like a 5 o'clock shadow for a kid who's supposed to be, what, I think it was
17.
13?
Like, by the time
when
he would have come back,
yeah.
He would have been 17.
But regardless, his family takes him in. And it's the whole thing about how they basically come to the realization that, you know, there's an imposter in the house, and also there's the question of what happened to the kid. It's a story that when you watch it, you'd say this is ridiculous. If it was a movie, a fictional film, you would walk out going, this is crap. There's no way that
it's too far-fetched.
But the fact that it really happened and that they're actually talking to all the people involved, it is fascinating. On top of that, it's one of the best looking documentaries I have seen in years.
Yep.
Like the way how it blends the talking head segments, which again are shot gloriously, I think they use Red Camera for it, and then also a lot of the reenactments, and then the way how they edit the reenactments with those scenes
and
so,
the audio clips too.
Yeah, so 1 minute the imposter is telling you a story, and then you cut to the actor, you know, acting out what, as he's saying it and back. And then just like the way how they cut to certain moments where a character will say something and then they'll cut to the imposter giving like a kind of smirk. Like, yeah, it, I can't believe they bought that. You know, it just, but it's fantastic. And it was one that I saw at Hot Docs. I think it was like the first or the second night of Hot Docs. And I went back 2 days later just to see it again because I had a spot in my schedule. I was like, oh, I can go see it. And it still played Gangbusters the second time around.
Did you see it as well?
I didn't.
You kind of watched bits and pieces of it with me.
You, I hadn't intended to. We had watched, I think, already like 3 movies in a row or something. And I left the room to work or bake or something. And you put it on, so I wasn't going to watch another movie with you. But I could kind of hear it and I kind of became involved. And I kept coming in going, what? What's happening? That, sorry, he pretended to be, so I got intrigued not even watching it, and then I kept getting sucked in, and so I didn't see 100% of the film, but what I saw, I mean, for a movie that I had no intention of, I hadn't even heard of it, I didn't know what you were watching. I was like, is that a documentary or is that a film? Because I couldn't quite understand what was happening in the other
room. What makes this movie so amazing, like, people talk to me all the time about how can you watch so many docs, doesn't it get boring? No. Real life is much better than fiction because crap like this happens all the time. And what makes this movie so great, like you said, is again kind of like what we said with Argo. It executes. It is a wonder to look at. It just keeps humming along the way. It intercuts everything we know already and what we find out. How, you know, you think you, like, the story basically shows us cards in the first 5 minutes, but there's it then tells you there's more to it. Like, we're not gonna keep you around for 90 minutes if it's just this guy was not this kid. That'd be just bloody useless. Right? You're not going to tell
it's
them.
It's an editor's film, which, again, is
but it's also a director's film, because there are other documentaries this year that are about more important subjects. Just, they're ugly, and they're not...
Yeah, they did a great job. I mean, stuff like this, the reason why it's intriguing, because when you get a documentary, just because I do this for a living, when they shoot the footage and they give it to you, there is no story. It's just a bunch of interviews of people telling their whole story beginning to end from different people. So it's the way that, and like you said, they would intercut it between a reenactment and an interview, and sometimes the lines were blurred on what was what, and then they just cut in a facial expression, stuff like that. The cuts are telling the story, and it was beautifully done.
And every character in that film, yes.
And it kind of had, we haven't seen this in a long time, but something as interesting as that keeps you guessing, like capturing the Friedmans. Yeah. Where at the end of that film, you were like, I don't know what to think. Like, clearly the guy was a child molester, but did he do this crime? And this film, you're like, well, clearly we know this guy stole the identity, but where's the kid?
Yeah, and
did the parents kill him? Did someone else? Is he even dead? Like, there's.
Yeah, there are no heroes in this story. So I'm definitely looking forward to you checking it out and finding out what you think. Your number one choice, so you get the last word on it. Why did it resonate for you?
It was one that, to this day, I still think about. And Hot Docs was what, since?
May.
April. And it still fascinates me. The private investigator, one of the best on-screen characters of the
year. Oh yeah, I forgot about him.
You forget about him. You see him, you know, and you think this is a real guy. Even if he's playing it up for a bit for the cameras, like, when they talk to everyone else, like, no, this is him. And how he kind of cracks an important part of the case, and how he does it. Just think about how did this guy achieve what he did in terms of impersonating and get as far as he did without anyone.
Which is something that
out.
Interpol couldn't do, that the FBI couldn't do, that national security couldn't do. This bumpkin of a private eye puts these pieces together. So I'm definitely looking.
It's one that I don't think a lot of people have seen.
No, and I really, I think if I'm
does
not.
Does it even have a proper release? Or
it came and went. I think it's actually on Netflix now.
Oh, okay.
So I check that. And anybody who's listening to this who goes on Netflix, look for The Imposter, because you're right, it is one awesome movie. Your number one is the one that made everybody's list except mine, but not for lack of charm, for sure. What is your number one film of 2012?
My number one is surprising to me is Moonrise Kingdom.
Why is that surprising to you?
Because I really liked it when I saw it, but I don't think I ever thought this is my favorite film of the year. And it wasn't until, I think, yesterday when I was putting my films, like every film that I've seen all year in order, and I would be like, I do one of 10. Did I like this better than this? And Moonrise was one of the first ones I put down because I saw it so long ago. And when I got to the end and I hadn't put anything on top of it, I was like, oh, I didn't actually see that coming. But I love the film, and I just didn't see anything this year that I enjoyed more than that.
You guys both had it on your list as well. And like with me, I think it landed at like number 7. Mm-hmm. Like again, it's one of these ones that like just missed the cut. Like, are you guys fans of Wes Anderson in general, or was it like kind of the one that kind of got you in a little bit more than usual?
I don't know who directs what.
Oh,
I think
good that you're on this show.
I really don't like. I just Rushmore, like a film, Roman, or I don't like a film.
Okay,
like, but I did see. I think Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah,
is
that
the
was
same
her. I think her first introduction to
and
Wes Anderson.
I was prepared to hate it, and
really?
I loved Fantastic Mr. Fox. So I was like, okay, cool, let's see this one, and I really, really liked it. Just the quirkiness of it, and it was shot in a way that it seemed to me like an old film. Like I don't know how to
just the way he frames some shots. Like the way some things are framed, like the way they frame Bob Balaban in some of those shots. Like sometimes he'd be like just standing in the center of this empty space.
Like, it was neat.
And sometimes he'd be on the side with the, like
he'd have the leg up.
He wouldn't even say anything, but you're already smiling just because there's something. He's got the scarf, and he's just it's. I don't know another director that can just, before anyone opens their mouths or makes a joke or does anything, you take a look at a person, you look at the way a shot is framed, and you just feel joy.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, they just smiled a lot.
My favorite shot, probably of the whole year, that just makes me smile thinking about it, is when they're in the tent and Bill Murray's like running for the tent and lifts it up.
That was a great shot.
Yeah. Okay, now we can't get it.
That was a great shot.
I just think that, just that shot, it's so simple, but it's like probably my favorite of the year.
Yeah. The thing I love about it is it really encapsulates kind of this very thin sliver of youth in between being a kid and being a teenager. Like these kids, they're aware. Let's put it that way. You know, they at first they look like they might be too young, but we get it. No, they're not exactly too young, but not in an icky way.
Yeah.
You know, like in a really kind of natural, almost sweet way. You know, it kind of it's kind of encapsulated in that moment of what kind of bird are you? Like they both got that look in their eyes of this is the person who I've been waiting for, that I've read stories about, and who is sitting there to be found, or who's come and found me, and plans are afoot. And as well, the other thing I like about it is it kind of encapsulates that moment when we're younger where stuff seems possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get older and things like long distance relationships all of a sudden like that you don't want to bother with it, or somebody who's got baggage you don't want to bother with it. When you're younger, the world is no problem. You can do it without a problem, and that's what these two kids have. It's a kid who's basically an orphan. It's a girl who feels like he's misunderstood. And they've got everybody kind of trying to keep them apart, but it's no problem for them. And I don't know, I think we can kind of get away from that as we get older.
And I appreciate things like, you know, the group of kids that are kind of chasing them, they're kind of his bullies, but by the end of the movie, they're rallying and helping him.
Yeah.
And that's just a little thing, because I like positivity in general, and I appreciate, I don't always want things to be dark, and I just like little things, like the kids' personalities didn't change, and they just all decided, you know what, we should just help them.
But the dog died.
The dog died. That was a little traumatizing. And for most of the movie, I was so worried about that kitten.
Well, I would say that with Wes Anderson, who I do hope that you get to see, Dion, that you get to see more of now that you like this movie. I actually say this is like the quintessential movie. It's like everything that the guy does is smack in the middle of this film. So if you like this, you'll probably like the other stuff he does. In your own good time. This was your choice as number one. So why?
Mainly, in terms of filmmaking, I like his use of pacing and the way his framing. There's just something about, especially when I compare it to Les Mis.
and we're going back there.
No, but when you look at just visually the way something is shot, and then you have something this where there's just a composition in his shots that are interesting. Like, Tom Hooper was trying to be interesting, but I think Anderson is actually succeeded in doing something slightly different. Like, none of his framings are kind of how other directors would probably do them. He either puts the camera a little lower, or he frames them a little off-center, or maybe a little too center, but there's just something inherently quirky or unique about it. And it just makes me smile.
Cool. You guys want to hear the sound of a few dozen podcast listeners all turning off an episode at the same time? This is where everybody's going to think I'm nuts. Because my number one film of the year is Ridley Scott's Prometheus.
Boo! No, I'm kidding. I actually don't hate it.
Yes! Exactly. So I know you sort of saw it.
Okay, I watched it. There is a chance I was playing Sudoku on my phone while it was going on. Yeah. I'm just going to put this out there.
Did you see it?
I did see it.
And you did not see
it? No, I did not.
Okay. Can you corroborate the fact that everybody who listens to the show, with the exception of Matthew Brown, probably thinks I'm crazy right now?
Yeah, I think my cousin would probably agree with you, although I don't think he listens to this show.
Okay.
But he liked it the first time, and then he went and saw it again. He said it worked better on rewatch. I've only watched it once. I enjoyed it when I saw it. I thought the last 30 minutes is where I had most of my issues.
Okay.
And I think that's where they're really trying to tie it to Alien.
Yeah.
And that's why I think the film fell apart.
So here's why it's my number one and why it stuck with me. Is that for a movie that's supposed to be this great big sci-fi epic, it was actually a film that was more interested in telling us about ourselves. And for the second time in 2 years, I went and watched a movie that completely took me out of the theater and got me thinking about things like God and existentialism and where do we come from and where are we going and all that other stuff. And I did not expect that from a Ridley Scott sci-fi movie. It talks about the consequences of scientific advancement and you know, is every invention and innovation that we come up with, is it a good thing? Like, is it a good thing that now our kids grow up that much faster because we have information at the click of a mouse? It talked about there were characters who were trying to fill very large voids. There was a robot who was trying to be human, and there was a scientist who was trying to come to grips with her relationship with God. A scientist who was trying to come to a relationship with her.
Sounds interesting.
That in itself, you know. Now, of course, I'm selling it this way, but if you were to listen to a lot of other people talk about it, they would get hung up on things like astronauts who take off their helmets in space, or people who run away from something that is falling and don't think to zag when they should be zigging, or characters who get lost when they're very clearly on a map. There's all kinds of nitpick that happens around this film.
None of that stuff bothers me, mainly because, I mean, the plot holes in Dark Knight were much bigger, but I thought that was a better movie. I did enjoy
it. Ask a few people and they'd probably say that this gives it a run, but okay.
I will admit, I don't even think I've admitted this to you, I didn't hate Prometheus. I didn't even dislike Prometheus.
Good night, everybody.
The thing is, when we watched it, you were being a little aggressively pretentious about it.
Because I've
It was difficult for me to admit that I semi-liked it.
Okay.
So I had to just kind of put you in your place a little bit.
I will admit this much. By the time you and I watched it, I had spent 4 months, like, arguing with
see,
all...
See, you were arguing with me on stuff before I'd even said it,
yeah,
and I was so
annoyed. Yeah, that's
that
exactly
that.
I was overcompensating.
Yeah, like, you were defensively arguing that. I think I was just like, oh, come on. So I think I gave it a harder time. I will watch it again.
Hey, awesome!
Yeah, I will watch it. We can do it now.
We can pause this.
I didn't dislike it. I had problems with it.
Yeah.
Oh, like, I had quite a few problems, but okay. I didn't dislike it. You were just... It's like... I understand how it's like when people sit in a room and watch Hedwig and the Angry Inch with me.
Yeah, okay, so you know where I'm
coming
from.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm already like, no, this, like, the movie's still going. I'm like, the symbolism in this scene.
Watch this.
Yeah, like, it's really annoying.
Okay, were you just okay with it, or?
No, I...
Like, am I completely nuts?
No, I'm
just kind of nuts.
I liked it, and, again, I had issues with the ending. Pretty much everything up until just after the surgery, I thought was...
So you don't fantastic. Like so you don't like when they go to the you don't like when the space jockey really enters into it.
It lost me more in the sense that it was a really fascinating film in the sense that it was creating its own specific universe.
Right.
And I was willing to go with it. Even thought the surgery scene was fantastic when they have the reveal of who else is on the ship. Interesting. And then it felt like the last bit for me personally was, okay, we need to tie it to this other existing piece. And I would have loved if it was just a film on its own.
Okay.
You know? Now, and they claim it's, well, it's set in the same universe and it's not really tied to it. But then why do you have that money shot at the very end?
Surprisingly, I really hated Charlize Theron in this.
But you're supposed to.
Yeah, you're
No, but
you're
I
not
didn't.
Like
I actually thought she was flat, like, in terms of. Like, they wrote her saying you're not supposed to like her and she's just supposed to be hard and, oh, she's got daddy issues, but I don't think they fleshed it out enough and I just felt like it was really forced.
See, I thought that worked though, because I like the dynamic between her Michael Fassbender. You know, Fassbender is the
I love the
android, but is treated like the brother, the loving brother that the father dotes on. Where
I
she's
think this
like
is the most I've ever liked Fassbender, actually.
I apparently am not completely crazy, although me having him on the top makes me sort of nuts. I do, again, I hope you watch it, and then you can maybe... Are you big on the sci-fi, like Aliens and...
It, again...
Well, no, you were saying earlier that you like sci-fi.
I do. Certain things...
It just depends
on did you like Blade Runner?
I didn't see Blade Runner.
Oh, Morty. now you have two movies to watch, along with everything else that we've talked about. That was the thing for me, is I think actually that this is a movie that is going to age very, very well. There's a lot of sci-fi out there that deals with these kinds of topics that weren't received very well, that went on to age remarkably well. Brazil, Blade Runner, 2001 A Space Odyssey, none of them were really like championed when they first came out, and then everybody kind of grabbed on. That's not to say that I think that this is exactly in a class with those kind of movies, but I think it could be.
No, so, it's a film that I am intrigued to watch again. Actually, when we were at Walmart earlier today, I actually had the DVD.
Buy it.
Because they had it in the boxing week sale for $10. And
the
Blu-ray I kept
is
looking
glorious.
At it, and I kept hemming and hawing. And I might go back and get it. Because it's one that I want to revisit again. I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
There was a lot to it that I really liked. I just had some issues with the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That's why I wouldn't put it in my top 10 personally.
That is what
but...
a stop button is for.
Yeah.
And so, I'm not married so much to the Alien films that the ending bot like that them trying to tie stuff together. It was kind of annoying to have him keep explaining to me how it tied into the other films.
Well, that is all for episode 75 of the Matinee Kiss. I think it's been a good year in movies. What do you say?
Very good.
Come on back, folks, on Monday, January 14th for episode 76, we'll discuss the nominees for the 85th annual Oscars. Courtney writes at bigthoughtsforthesmallmind.com. Do you have anything coming up next week that you want to plug?
I guess the full top 10 list should be out by the time this goes up, or maybe a day after this goes up.
Yeah, this is going up New Year's Eve, so...
So yeah, New Year's Day.
There we go. Go to Small Mind and look for the top 10. Where can people find you on Twitter?
At Small Mind.
There we go. Yeah, are you on Twitter? People want to look you up.
Don't Twitter.
You're off the grid. Look at you go. I can't remember. I think you contribute every once in a blue moon to Small Mind, don't you?
Occasionally.
Kind of with the frequency that Lindsay contributes.
Yeah.
Yeah, once in a while I try and do like a
interview.
I like it. Do more of those. And Linz, just in case people haven't figured it out from the last episode, where can people find you on Twitter?
At Lindsay Ragone, LindsayRagone.
Very cool. My site is thematinee.ca for more podcast content. You can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry, Listen, the iTunes Music Store, and they all give you handy ways to subscribe for free. The alerts when new episodes drop, feedback on any of the 18 films we've talked about, including why I'm nuts about Prometheus, can be left in the comment section. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca, or Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca. For Courtney, Dion, Lindsay, I am Ryan. Happy New Year. We'll see you at the matinee.